This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel. The Murder of Mary Fagan, Part 4. We're going to focus this time on Pinkerton's, Pinkerton Detective Agency that I touched on the last time. We're going to go into some detail here, and especially about their main agent, Harry Scott, and his involvement in the investigation and trial. I wanted to know a little bit about Pinkerton. It turns out that the company is still around. It has a website, and on its history page, it gives a few interesting details. It describes itself, its tagline is, from protecting Midwestern railways to providing corporate risk management to clients across the globe. That's what its business model is. Now, at the time of the Leo Frank trial and the murder of Mary Fagan, it was a detective agency. It was founded by a man named Alan Pinkerton. He was born in 1819 in Glasgow, Scotland. He immigrated to the U.S. in 1842. By 1847, he had joined the Chicago police. In 1849, he became the first detective in Chicago, first official employed detective of the police in Chicago. In 1850, he left the police in Chicago to form the Pinkerton Detective Agency. And also in 1850, the company created something called the Pinkerton Code. And the first three items on that in that code are: accept no bribes, never compromise with criminals, partner with local law enforcement agencies. And there are some more points to that, but those three in particular, they're the first three, and they are the most relevant to what we're going to talk about this time. Interestingly enough, there is no mention of the Leo Frank trial in the history, in the corporate history here, but it is a kind of coarse, high-level history. It doesn't list every case that they were involved in. But it is somewhat controversial, their involvement in this case. And when I was poking around trying to figure out what this case was about and what was going on with it, and in particular about the Pinkerton's involvement in it, and you search for Pinkerton and Leo Frank, you find some interesting things. And as I made the point before, a lot of what you find, if not most, is the Jewish version of things. And one in particular, I'll read their description of it from a page titled The Lynching of Leo Frank, which is a tip-off that this is the Jewish version that's what they're focused on. Coincidentally, Leo Frank hired the services of the Pinkerton Detective Agency to investigate. The day after the murder, in fact, is when they were hired. Recognizing the public climate against Frank, Harry Scott, the chief Pinkerton detective, admitted that they changed their efforts and decided to gather evidence against Frank, since the Pinkertons would be chased out of Atlanta if Frank were to be set free. That last sentence there is speculation. It's actually the last clause. It's after the comma. But the fact is, from my reading of it, is that, yes, the Pinkertons were hired by the National Pencil Company to investigate, and that eventually Harry Scott, the lead investigator, the chief detective, became convinced that Leo Frank was actually the one who had committed the crime. And so his attitude changed. I don't think there's any doubt about that. The issue is, why did it change? And as I've already said, the surface reason, the reason that Scott himself gave, is that he had come to the conclusion that from the evidence that he had seen that Frank was guilty, and that's why he testified ultimately in court against Frank. And his testimony was considered very damaging to Frank. Another bit of evidence about Pinkerton, I found two documents on the leofrank.org website. Now, this is the site that's a very good resource, lots and lots of documents about the case, about the murder, and presented in a almost like archive.org or the Internet Archive fashion of just the facts. And there are some editorials there. But when it comes to the Pinkertons, there's one court document, which I found a little strange as I was trying to understand this. It's just a court document from 1917. And it seems to be it's hard to make sense of it unless you know legalese, but it's basically the Pinkertons suing the pencil company for their unpaid bills. When they were hired, they were never paid. And this is important because the other document that leofrank.org links having to do with the Pinkertons is an article that it copied from another website, from AmericanHeritage.com, written by Stephen J. Goldfarb, who they describe as an Atlanta librarian. Now, the name Goldfarb is a Jewish surname. It's Ashkenazi specifically, and it's German. That means gold color. The title of Goldfarb's article, and it's all about Pinkertons and especially Harry Scott, and I'll get into this in some detail here. The title of Goldfarb's article is Framed. And that's, in a nutshell, that is what his point is. You know, this whole article is that Leo Frank was framed. To go into a longer description of what the article is, they describe it at the very top with this sentence summarizing it. A newly discovered document casts a disturbing light on exactly how Frank's prosecutor won his case. Now, this is a hint as to why that court document is on leofrank.org, because I don't think that that's exactly the document that Goldfarb is talking about, but that's the case that Goldfarb is talking about as if it's newly discovered. It's the facts of the case or the brief of evidence is what Goldfarb is referring to. This was an article, by the way, that was published in October of 1996. And it's just to summarize it from my point of view, it's five pages of much ado about nothing. It's taking some details that have long been known, some details about the case, and inverting reality, and I'll explain how he goes about that. And a key point is that he does an awful lot of speculating about the motives of Harry Scott and others involved in the case. And he assumes that they were operating in bad faith, that Scott and Pinkerton were operating in bad faith, because that's the claim that the National Pencil Company made in their lawsuit, which was defeated. But I'm getting ahead of myself. He writes, and this is Goldfarb writing, the reason that the National Pencil Company refused to pay Pinkerton can be found in the amended motion for a new trial in which the National Pencil Company claimed that Pinkerton, quote, did not seek honestly and in good faith to ascertain the truth, but on the contrary, endeavored dishonestly and in bad faith to suppress and distort the truth and to bring about the conviction of Frank regardless of guilt or innocence, unquote. Now, that's the National Pencil Company's position because they didn't want to pay their bill. They impugned Harry Scott for not doing his job. And what Goldfarb is doing is basically pulling up this document from 1917, and he's echoing it as if it's some new discovery. He continues, the National Pencil Company's case against Pinkerton turned on the actions of the agency's employee, Harry Scott. As assistant superintendent of Pinkerton's Atlanta office, Scott was in charge of the investigation of the Fagan murder from the day after her body was discovered in late April until sometime in August, the month Frank was convicted. Ironically, it was Leo Frank himself, as manager of the pencil factory, who arranged with Scott to hire Pinkerton. Not only did Scott take an active part in the investigation, he also supervised all the numerous Pinkerton employees looking into the crime. Well, the fact of the case, as I've already said, is that the National Pencil Company lost, which means that their argument that Goldfarb is echoing now, 100 years later or so, didn't convince the people at the time, the judge and the jury at the time, if there was a jury in this civil case, that Scott did anything wrong. They failed to convince the judge of that. And it's more sensible, I think, 100 years in retrospect, to assume that they were right in their judgment and to speculate that it was the National Pencil Company that was actually the ones that were operating in bad faith, that they hired Pinkerton initially to help exonerate Frank, to help save Frank and or the company from embarrassment, and potentially to help frame the two black employees. And that ultimately, when it didn't go their way, that they were operating in bad faith and that they didn't want to pay their bill. And those are pretty simple motives. I mean, you don't have to bend over backwards. You don't have to turn reality upside down to imagine that those two things were very real, or at least potentially real motives in explaining why NPC, why the National Pencil Company did what they did. Now, Goldfarb admits that Scott's testimony was, quote, a devastating setback for the defense. And he explains why. He says, because it undermined the veracity of the defendant's, that's Frank's, testimony. Worse still, Scott posed not only as a disinterested third party whose only concern was the truth, but it is an employee of the defense. Well, actually, he posed as an employee of the defense whose only concern was the truth. And that again, that's on the surface. That's how he presented himself. That's how people took his word at the time. It's really Goldfarb that wants to act as if he's a disinterested third party and turn that reality upside down 100 years later. Though the trial had been underway for several days, Scott was the first witness who really aided the case against Frank, according to Goldfarb. Rosser, that's the defense attorney, the head defense attorney for Frank, was emphatic about how the changes in Scott's testimony had damaged the defense. Well, how Scott's testimony had damaged the defense, really. The changes, that's part of the nitpicking over the details that I said that most of this article is about. The fact that Scott changed his attitude isn't really disputed. He was hired initially by the National Pencil Company, and at the time, Leo Frank wasn't under suspicion, and Harry Scott didn't suspect Leo Frank either. It was after he started to go through the evidence and started to experience things himself that he changed his mind. And that's really the change. That's the important change, and that's the change that Goldfarb is waving his hands, trying to get his reader not to see, and instead imagine that it was some sort of nefarious change in Scott's mind, that he, for some inexplicable reason, maybe just Jew hate, which is the usual reason that Jews provide for why their enemies do anything, is that caused Scott to do this thing. I don't find it believable myself. The purpose of the article, in fact, you can see, is really Goldfarb sees that Scott's testimony was damaging, and he's writing this article to try and undo that damage, to try and say that that was the key aspect of the trial, that the whole trial hinged on that testimony, and therefore, because Scott was really a bad guy who did this in bad faith, his claim, that Frank was didn't get a fair trial. And to do that, he had to turn reality on its head. He had to, rather than accept Scott as a man of integrity, had to flip it around and defame him. Now, he writes a few more paragraphs here. I'm debating whether to read them. I guess I will, because it's some interesting facts about the case. In itself, this document, he's talking about the brief of evidence now that he's discovered after so long, does not prove guilt or innocence. It does, however, add substantially to the evidence that Leo Frank did not receive a fair trial. In fact, the conclusion that he was railroaded is now inescapable. There's no such thing, really. That's just a bald assertion on Goldfarb's from Goldfarb's mind. Whatever his reasons, Harry Scott was a key figure in the convicting Frank of murder. Less certain, but still highly suggestive, was the malign role played by the prosecutor, Hugh Dorsey. Now, this is where Goldfarb himself is maligning another dead man who can't defend himself, who, on the surface and from every account in the day, was an upstanding man who did his job properly, just like Scott did. But he goes on to imply that Dorsey and Scott collaborated. It seems their collaboration seems to have assured that Leo Frank would not receive a fair trial for the crime he almost certainly did not commit. And this brings back the statement on that plaque the Jews put up where Frank was ultimately hung. Wrongly accused, falsely convicted, wantonly murdered. That's the Jewish narrative about the Leo Frank trial, about the murder of Mary Fagan. It doesn't even there's nothing about Mary Fagan in it. It's all about Frank, and it's Frank was a victim. What Goldfarb's contribution is he takes it even a step further. He was framed. Frank was framed. So, but it's, you know, still in line with the same the point, which is that Frank is the victim, not Mary Fagan. Leo Frank was the victim, according to the Jews. And we can believe that, or we can believe that Scott and Dorsey were honest men who worked to convict Frank because they thought he was the murderer. And actually, either way, whether they, you know, whatever they did, the issue about whether Frank, Leo Frank, actually murdered Mary Fagan or not is somewhat of a separate issue. And Goldfarb really is leaping to a conclusion there by saying that if he finds something wrong with either of those two men, that must mean that Leo Frank is innocent, because it doesn't mean that. It could very well be that those two guys are the worst guys on the planet. And still, that doesn't mean that Leo Frank is innocent and didn't commit the murder. The way Goldfarb argues is like the long line of people all along who have been willing to say and do whatever is necessary to exonerate Frank. It started almost immediately after Mary Fagan was murdered, with the attempts to manipulate the investigation, all the way through to the Jewish attempts to overturn the judgment, and finally overturning the judgment and getting his sentence to death commuted to life in jail. And it continues to this day with the attempts to invert reality, even if it means impugning and defaming honest men who did their jobs properly. And it's all to fit their narrative that paints Frank as the victim. Now, why? What's the motive? It's fair enough to ask. Goldfarb thinks it's fair to speculate about the motives of people who are long dead. I think it's, in the case of Goldfarb especially, I think it's out of care for his tribe. I think it's to help a member of his tribe. At the time, it was to help a member of their tribe. And it's to help the tribe, really, and to help themselves as part of that tribe, that they do it. It's out of ethnic solidarity that Jews come to the defense of Leo Frank. I think that's pretty obvious, but when you say that sort of thing, that's exactly the sort of thing that Jews jump up and down and scream, that that's anti-Semitism, that that's hate. But here they are speculating with no real explanation offered as to the motives of other people. And I think my speculation is far more grounded in reality and truth, closer to the truth. Now, besides whatever Scott or Dorsey did in this case and whatever their testimony was worth, whatever Dorsey's efforts as the prosecutor were worth. There are many other reasons to believe that Frank is actually guilty of this crime. There's a document, a page at the American Mercury titled 100 Reasons Leo Frank is Guilty. And this came up in previous searches I had done, but it also came up in the case of the Pinkertons. And I'll focus initially here on some of the stuff that involves the Pinkertons. It was published in the 26th of April on the 100th anniversary of the murder itself in 2013, so earlier this year, by the editor of the American Mercury. And it's really not 100 separate reasons. It's more like 100 paragraphs, although some of the later itemized points are multiple paragraphs. The first 50 or so are individual paragraphs, just numbered. And what I see in them is two main themes that I've already talked about, and I'll go into more detail here now in touching on each one that the American Mercury mentions. And the two main themes are the manipulation of the investigation, and specifically the private investigators that were involved. It was not just the Pinkertons, but there was another. We'll get to that. And also the second major theme is the testimony and behavior of Frank himself. So let's talk first about the manipulation, what I call the manipulation of the investigation. This is my groupings, by the way. The American Mercury just lists 100 itemized paragraphs, and they're a little jumbled in order. So I've rearranged some things here to pull the Pinkerton private investigator stuff to the front. And item 19 says that the Pinkertons were hired by Sigmund Montag of the National Pencil Company at behest of Leo Frank, with the understanding that they were to ferret, quote, ferret out the murderer no matter who he was, unquote. I mentioned that, I think that's important because I think the last installment or the one before I wasn't sure who hired Pinkerton. So now we know it was definitely who it was, Sigmund Montag of the National Pencil Company. After Leo Frank was convicted, Harry Scott and the Pinkertons were stiffed out of an investigation bill totaling some $1,300 for their investigative work that had indeed helped to, quote, ferret out the murderer, no matter who he was, unquote. And the Pinkertons had to sue to win their wages and expenses in court, but were never able to fully collect. That's that document that I talked about at the beginning here, the court document, and the case that Goldfarb thinks is so important and proves that Leo Frank was wrongly convicted, framed, in fact. Item 20 says that this is not to say that there were not factions within the Pinkertons, though. One faction was not averse to planting false evidence. A Pinkerton agent named W.D. McWirth, 3 weeks after the entire factory had been meticulously examined by police and Pinkerton men, miraculously discovered a bloody club, a piece of cord like that used to strangle Mary Fagan, and an alleged piece of Mary Fagan's pay envelope on the first floor of the factory near where the factory's black sweeper, Jim Conley, had been sitting on the fatal day. This was the beginning of the attempt to place guilt for the killing on Conley, an effort which still continues 100 years later. The discovery was so obviously and patently false that it was greeted with disbelief by almost everyone, and McWirth was pulled off the investigation and eventually discharged by the Pinkerton agency. It also came out, this is item 21 now, that McWirth had made his finds, quote-unquote finds, while Chief Pinkerton investigator Harry Scott was out of town. Most interestingly, and contrary to Scott's direct orders, McWirth's discoveries were reported immediately to Frank's defense team, but not at all to the police. And that's italicized. I guess Scott's orders were to report it to both, or maybe just to the police. But McWirth didn't do that. A year later, McWirth surfaced once more, now as a Burns agency operative, a firm which by then was openly working in the interests of Frank. One must ask, who would pay for such obstruction of justice and why? This gets to the point I brought up the last time as to what police, the terms that police think in is who has the motive to do a crime and who has the ability, who has the means to do it. And if the blacks either one of these blacks who were initially accused, Newt Lee, the night watchman, who was initially suspected, who had found the body, and that the white crowd had gathered and wanted to lynch on the first day after the murder. If he was the one that was guilty, was he the one putting up this private investigator to this kind of behavior, to planting evidence? Or was it the other black, Jim Connolly, the sweeper in the factory that has become the focus since the trial, during the trial and since the trial, as the trial determined he was sort of an accessory, an aid to Frank after the fact, and since the trial has become the scapegoat that the Jews would like to blame instead for the murder. And we'll get into that a little bit here in this 100 Reasons. They talk about that a bit. Item number 35 says Pinkerton Detective Harry Scott, who was employed by Leo Frank to investigate the murder, testified that he was asked by Frank's defense team to withhold from the police any evidence his agency might find until after giving it to Frank's lawyers. Scott refused. Recall now the Pinkerton code about not giving in to bribes, never compromising with criminals, and partnering with local law enforcement agencies. All three of those items come into play here as to why Scott behaved the way he did. He was acting with integrity according to the code of his company, according to what he thought was right. Item number 46 now mentions this Burns agency, these competitors to Pinkerton. In May, around the time of the disgraced Pinkerton Detective McWirth's attempt to plant the fake evidence, which caused McWirth's dismissal, attorney Thomas Felder made his loud but mysterious appearance. Quote-unquote Colonel Felder, as he was known, was soliciting donations to bring in yet another private detective agency to the case, Pinkerton's great rival, the William Burns Agency. Felder claimed to be representing neighbors, friends, and family members of Mary Fagan. But Mary Fagan's stepfather, J.W. Coleman, was so angered by this misrepresentation that he made an affidavit denying that there was any connection between him and Felder. It was widely believed that Felder and Burns were secretly retained by Frank supporters. The most logical interpretation of these events is that, having largely failed in getting Pinkerton to perform corrupt acts on behalf of Frank, Frank's supporters decided to covertly bring in another, and hopefully more cooperative agency into the case. Felder and his, quote, unselfish efforts were their cover. Felder's representations were seen as deception by many, which led more and more people to question Frank's innocence. This article, by the way, with the 100 Reasons, gives extensive links, mostly back to archived images, PDF documents containing images of newspapers of the day as citations for this evidence, and cites also some archive.org documents having to do with the trial documents themselves as to what people testified to in trial. Item number 44, several young women, and this is the next thing about Frank's pattern of harassment of girls in the time leading up to the murder of Mary Fagan. Several young women and girls testified at the inquest that Frank had made improper advances toward them, in one instance touching a girl's breast and in another appearing to offer money for compliance with his desires. The Atlanta Georgian reported, quote, girls and women were called to the stand to testify that they were employed at the factory or had on occasion to go there and that Frank had attempted familiarities with them. So this speaks to a pattern of behavior of Frank that had nothing to do with other men and what they might be doing to frame him.